Well, thank you all for attending. We're doing the Fats, Fuels, and Oils webinar, forecasting webinar for the week of January 25th. If anybody has questions, please go ahead and drop them into the Q&A section of Zoom, and we'll get to them at the end of Tori's presentation here. With that, I'll pass it to you, Tori. Take it from here.
Thanks, George. So it has been another volatile couple of weeks in soybean oil prices. Soybean oil kind of suffered from a double whammy of first a sharp drop in palm oil values and then a steep decline in soybean futures. The decline in palm oil was driven mainly by concerns about slowing exports, with cargo surveyor data indicating that exports for the first 20 days dropped about 40% in December from the same period, or in January from the same period in December. That slowed down a little bit, or I guess it narrowed, the difference narrowed a little bit over the first 25 days. So it was about 35%. But there's still some big concerns about world vegetable oil demand. I think the concerns might be a little bit overplayed. I think part of the reason that you're seeing the sharp decline in Malaysian palm oil exports is due to a shift in export tax policy, and also the difference in the fundamentals between Malaysia and Indonesia. So I think that those exports are probably going to Indonesia, although it's tough to tell because the Indonesian government doesn't provide data in a super timely manner. And so it's a bit of a black hole. There certainly probably is a little bit of slowdown after pretty strong exports in December anyway, but I'm not sure it's to the extent that is being reflected in the cargo surveyor data. And there are anecdotal reports suggesting that the Indonesian government will change its tax policy, which could swing those exports back to Malaysia potentially. Malaysia still has historically tight stocks, and so even if they do change the tax policy, I'm not sure that you will see all of a sudden a big rush of exports out of Malaysia. But that is something else that has been sort of distorting the export picture. On the soybean side, an improvement in weather conditions in Argentina contributed to a sharp sell-off last week in soybean prices. I think that, again, that probably was a little bit overdone. There's still a long ways to go in the growing season, and the Argentine crop ratings are significantly below where they were last year at the same time, as is the soil moisture. And it's not as if the forecast shifted to suggest that we're going to get rainfall every day going forward. And so you've seen a pretty sharp rally in soybean prices over the last couple of days, and that's helped support soybean oil prices. As a result of all of the soybean oil prices have kind of been range bound over the last couple of weeks, but I think with the recovery in soybean futures and the stabilization in Malaysian palm oil futures, soybean oil probably has a chance to run a little bit higher here. One of the interesting things that's come out of these moves is the spread between palm oil and soybean oil. I know I talk about this a lot, but the March contract spread, and the March contract is still sort of the benchmark contract for soybean oil, but the April contract is really the benchmark contract for palm oil now. So the indication here is not quite as strong as it was even a couple of weeks ago. But that's run back up to about 4 cents per pound premium for soybean oil from basically parity a couple of weeks ago. Maybe the more interesting spread to look at is the May contract that has jumped up to 7 cents per pound. I think that probably is well overdone and probably works its way lower as we go forward. This week, we're going to get USDA's monthly fats and oils report, and we expect that USDA will show a build in stocks at the end of December up to just below 2.3 billion pounds. We still expect stocks to kind of continue to build into April before rising demand, particularly from the biofuel industry and renewable biodiesel producers, potentially starts to draw stocks down. And by the end of the marketing year, we think stocks could be historically tight. Now, that said, if there are delays in some of the renewable diesel projects that we're expecting to come online later this year, then we probably will end up with soybean oil stocks that are higher than we're expecting. And that wouldn't necessarily surprise me a lot if that were to happen. The other thing that I kind of wanted to highlight in there is in for the report is domestic usage. Domestic usage we expect to remain relatively strong, up a bit from last year and about even with last month. Given what we've seen in basis levels and soybean oil prices, you might expect this to drop off a little bit, but demand from the renewable diesel industry or the renewable fuel industry has remained really robust, and we'll get into that in a second when we go through some of the EMTS data that came out last week. And so that's really the big contributor to the strength in domestic demand. But surprisingly, non-biofuel demand has also remained relatively strong, and we expect that to be just over a billion pounds. Now, we expect that non-biofuel demand will remain close to or above a billion pounds here for the next several months before it starts to draw down early in 2020, or well, late in 2021, early in the 2021-22 marketing year. There's some chance, again, that if some of the projects that we expect to come online are delayed, that the non-biofuel domestic demand will be stronger than we expect. We essentially cut 300 million pounds out of our 2021 forecast from 1920, basically from 13 billion pounds down to 12.7 billion pounds. And I think, again, the risk to that forecast is probably to the upside. If that comes, if we raise our projections as we go forward for non-biofuel usage, that may temper some of the drawdown or some of the reduction in the drawdown in stocks that may also occur as a result of any delays in renewable diesel facilities coming online. So anyway, our forecast is still basically unchanged from last week. You can see we're at the lower end of our forecast range, and we expect prices to remain well supported. This is really on the back of rising soybean futures. And if you could see our soybean futures forecast, it looks very similar to this. The main difference is that the soybean futures forecast here probably doesn't rise quite as sharply as soybean oil does. But we expect that prices for both are going to remain pretty well supported through July as the market starts to really get into rationing mode, given expectations for U.S. ending stocks to fall to historic lows and to a record low in terms of relative to demand. And so even with improving weather in Argentina and a good harvest in Brazil, we think that probably means that maybe soybean futures chop around here for a little bit between sort of $13 or $13.15 and 50 cents and $14 or $14.50. But we expect that the trend by the time we get to July will be, or the range by the time we get to July will be higher than it is today. And if you look at our outlook for canola oil prices have been really, really strong compared to soybean oil, and they've been much more resilient, although there was a lot of volatility over the past week. At some point, given the pace of crush in Canada and the pace of crush in the US, we expect some pressure on canola oil. But honestly, that's something I think that we've probably been forecasting for a month or two, and I don't know that it has necessarily materialized yet. Canola oil is really sort of backfilling for soybean oil because of the larger demand for soybean oil from biofuel producers, particularly biodiesel producers. So soybean or canola oil is filling in for some of that non-biofuel demand, and that's helped support prices. So again, if we get delays later in the year and soybean oil is able to take over a little bit more of the non-biofuel demand, that could also trigger some weakness in canola oil. But we do expect canola oil to rise into the end of the year, in part because we're expecting at some point EPA will approve a pathway for canola oil in renewable diesel production, and that'll give a big boost to demand and should support prices both in the US and in Canada. Palm oil kind of sideways here and then potentially down. On the supply side of palm oil, the La Nina has resulted in excessive rainfall that has caused some problems with production in January, and this is kind of offsetting part of the sharp decline in exports, and it could potentially offset most of that decline. However, we think that palm oil prices probably kind of trend sideways as the concerns about weakening demand continue, at least for the next couple of months, while palm oil goes through its seasonal decline in production. And then, of course, you have the upswing in production. And then I think that probably pressures palm oil prices in the second half of the year and drives the spread between palm oil and soybean oil up to its long-term historical average, which right now is kind of where it is in the March contract, the May contract certainly above that. But again, we expect that probably that range narrows back down here over the next couple of weeks and months. And then it probably starts to widen in the second half of the year again. All right, on to biodiesel. So we got biodiesel or EMTS data for December. You can see December came in a little bit above where we were last week. If you looked at this chart, December was essentially right on the yellow line, and biodiesel production came in about 7 million gallons above where we expected. With December done, that obviously concludes the year. Biodiesel production was just over 1.82 billion gallons, and renewable diesel production came in at 533 million gallons for total biomass-based diesel production of 2.356 billion gallons. That was a bit over the sum of our monthly forecasts. So every month we have forecasts and we adjust the monthly forecasts, but we take a copy of the month that we're in. So we copy December's forecast over, and then we look at that and use that to compare how the real data did relative to our projection. And so we kind of summed up those just to kind of see how our monthly forecast did against actual production. And we were pretty far below biodiesel, in part because of when COVID struck, we really cut our monthly forecast quite a bit. And then we spent basically the rest of the year kind of raising them. And so we were quite a bit below on that. I think we were like 1.75 billion gallons or something. In renewable diesel, we were a little bit closer. Renewable diesel came in at 533. I think we were at 525 or something. In part because while we didn't really see a big slowdown in biodiesel production due to the pandemic, there was some impact in renewable diesel, at least early on in the pandemic. Now, next year, we expect total biomass-based diesel production to grow to just over 3 billion gallons. Renewable diesel, we expect to be just over a billion gallons. And then biomass-based diesel, we expect to be just under 2 billion gallons. So renewable diesel production, we expect to almost double. And biodiesel production, we expect to grow, certainly not by as much as renewable diesel, but a little bit less than that. Combined, that's, again, just over 3 billion gallons. That's 29% growth. Ultimately, that may be a little bit optimistic. And as opposed to this year, where we spent the whole year sort of raising our forecast, next year we may spend the whole year, or in 2021, we may spend the whole year sort of cutting our forecasts a little bit. I think if we do cut our forecast, it's probably going to be on the biodiesel side, at least assuming that all of the renewable diesel projects come online as expected. Just by way of comparison, for 2019, renewable diesel production was 492 million gallons and biodiesel production was 1.71 billion gallons. So output grew almost 7% from 2019 to 2020, despite the pandemic and despite relatively low energy values, and certainly, and obviously, a record rise in the hobo spread. So, on to the gross margin forecast. We've got quite a dip here in our forecast for biodiesel, not so much for renewable diesel. This is due to the feedstock mix, because biodiesel is much more weighted towards soybean oil. So that big rise in soybean oil prices, we expect to weigh on biodiesel margins. Renewable diesel, we don't have any soybean oil in, and so the margins look a little bit steadier there. You see kind of the same thing even with credits, although renewable diesel margins look a little bit tougher with credits. And just to kind of show, this is the cost breakdown for renewable diesel. You can see sort of generally steadily rising prices for VFT and for the other components, but nothing as dramatic as we expect to see in soybean oil. You can see the soybean oil, we expect to rise pretty dramatically, obviously. Potentially offsetting that increase is our forecast for RIN prices, and we expect that maybe a little bit of pressure on RIN prices in the short term, but we expect them to bounce back to essentially about where they are now, and then to rise above where they are now by the end of the year. This doesn't necessarily look exactly right to me. I'm going to have to check this, because last night, actually, when I was doing this, I think I might need to do a refresh on this chart. We actually had RIN prices at about 100 cents per gallon here in the relatively near term, and then rising to as much as 200 cents per gallon by the time we get to December, due to the sharp increase in soybean oil prices, which is one of the components in the RIN price forecast. So I think this chart is probably stale from last week. If you're interested, you can check back in on this chart shortly after the webinar is done, and I'll just hit a refresh, and that'll look a little bit different. For EMTS, you can see here the annual supply for 2020, and then our forecast for 2021, and monthly, we're expecting, we can get this little bit in here, we're expecting a pretty significant increase in both D4 and D5 production, I guess, is the way that this is split up. All right, for the LCFS credit price, again, we still expect generally slowly trending lower. I think that's going to be our outlook basically through at least the first half of the year. Once we get a better sense of exactly when, or I guess as these renewable diesel facilities come online, then this forecast is the one that's most likely to change based on that, just because the additional supply probably will add a little bit more pressure to this. But I would expect over the next 2, 3, 4 months, you're not going to see something that's dramatically different than that forecast. Okay, with that, I will open it up for, the hobo spread, again, I think this is a, I think this might be last week's chart, because I think, again, we've got the hobo spread ultimately rising pretty sharply here by the end of 2021. So please check back, and I apologize that these weren't updated for the webinar. Okay, with that, I will open it up for questions.
All right, Tori, you got about 8 questions to field here in 8 minutes.
Rapid fire. My strength.
can you comment on the global production of UCO table? Or is that more of a Ryan question for next week?
I can comment on the global production of UCO table. So the way that we put together, and let me just pull this up here. The way that we put together this forecast, what we did is we looked at what we assumed. We built a model that we think works for the United States. And one of the components of that model we use is per capita income. And the idea is that as per capita income rises, people tend to go out to eat more, they tend to eat more processed foods, that kind of thing. And so used cooking oil production just generally should rise, but also as people tend to move up the per capita income scale, concerns about the environment and the infrastructure to do stuff like collect used cooking oil also increases. So what we did is, for the world, we built a model based on essentially, at its base on per capita income. And then we used not exactly always the exact same sort of per capita income to use cooking oil production numbers that we used for the US, but essentially we adjusted those a little bit. And then as per capita income grows, used cooking oil production grows along with it. So just kind of really quickly, that is the way that that we've built out the used cooking oil production part of it. And then we have sort of a trade matrix that we look at that shows used cooking oil exports from countries that may have a lot of used cooking oil, but don't necessarily have substantial renewable fuel programs in place yet. And then to countries like the United States that have pretty substantial renewable fuel programs and may also have strong used cooking oil production, but may need more than they can produce on their own.
All right, what's the risk of the Supreme Court case and outstanding SREs on the RIN forecast?
I don't think it's just me personally. I don't think there's a huge chance that that all of a sudden we're going to have a bunch of new SREs that are going to impact the mandates. I think that even if the Supreme Court case determines that that there should be more SREs, I guess is a simple way to put it, I think the new administration would probably do something to offset that, or the EPA potentially even could do something, I suppose, to limit the number of SREs that they grant or grant partial SREs. I imagine that would open up a whole new can of worms in terms of brand new court cases with the oil industry then potentially suing to have the EPA follow the rules of the Supreme Court. But again, I think the with the shift in the administration, I think the risk is relatively low. That said, there are a lot of SREs that are outstanding. If you look, and I didn't have a chance to look at the latest data, but in the prior month, if you looked at the number of SREs outstanding in November versus the number that were outstanding several months before, the EPA has denied a lot of the prior year SREs that were applied for after the 10th Circuit Court case. And so I think that that trend probably continues, and that was under the prior administration. And so I think that that trend probably continues, but I'm certainly not a legal expert, and I would imagine that either way, the one thing that is almost sort of guaranteed is that there will be more court cases after this, and the lawyers will make even more money.
Okay, thanks, Tori. What, if any, would be constraints on renewable diesel, and by extension, what does that mean for SBO levels?
So one of the constraints, I think, one of the big constraints is probably refining capacity. One of the things that we are going to look at increasingly in increasing detail in our quarterly outlook report is refining capacity and the ability of the refining capacity to meet the needs of growing renewable diesel demand. Obviously, I think for a lot of renewable diesel producers, their first choice for feedstocks are going to be the low CI feedstocks, especially if they are sort of selling into the California market or the Oregon market, or markets that come on and set up LCFS-like programs. But we also know that there aren't enough low CI feedstocks to go around to everybody. And so ultimately, they are going to have to default into using soybean oil. And we think, like I said earlier, that ultimately canola oil, a pathway for canola oil will also be approved by the end of 2021. In the interim, I think that the refining capacity is going to be the opposite of if you build it, they will come kind of thing, where instead of the refiners building up capacity in anticipation of the renewable diesel, the growth in renewable diesel demand, I think they probably will wait until that demand is there and then build out capacity. And so I think that could be a little bit of a drag on renewable diesel production. And I think that that may ultimately drive more renewable diesel producers to put refining in place in the front end of their plant, so that they don't have to deal with that capacity as they're developing their plans, than a lot of people are thinking right now. But that is probably the most significant impediment to renewable diesel production that I can see right now. The other one that I think is minor and probably more of an issue for biodiesel than renewable diesel is the expansion in fuel production in general. We've got, like you said, right now, we've got a pretty sharp increase year over year in the growth of biomass-based diesel production. And if that is well above mandated levels, you probably are going to need to rationalize some of that capacity. That's probably going to hit biodiesel producers first, and specifically non-integrated biodiesel producers that aren't selling into the California market. But there could be some smaller renewable diesel producers that also get crowded out of the market, just both just mainly from the perspective of if a bunch of new, very large competitors come into the market, their costs are going to be potentially lower. They're going to be able to pay up more for feedstocks, and the relationships with the people that sell the feedstocks are probably going to have an advantage there. And so it might have some small impact on smaller renewable diesel producers. But again, I think that the projected sort of overproduction that we have right now is probably more a problem for biodiesel producers than renewable diesel producers.
Tori, you mentioned renewable diesel break-evens don't change much as no SBO in that process, but you show a near doubling of soybean oil usage in renewable diesel from 2021 from 19 to 20. These appear to be in conflict.
Yeah, so that's more about the choices that we made when we set these charts up a while ago. We set these charts up, I guess, almost 2 years ago now, George.
All right.
And so at that point, what we decided to do was, it was two things. One, to focus on the California market because of the LCFS program. And then two, to make some choices about feedstock mix based on what we thought the most likely feedstock mix for renewable diesel producers in that market and biodiesel producers in that market would be. I think that it is close to time to make some revisions to our assumptions that probably more closely reflect the findings, or not the findings, just the results of our calendar year balance sheet. So if you look at our calendar year balance sheets, the way that we build those up is essentially we start with a list of all of the renewable diesel plants that we think are going to come online and when they're going to come online, and then some assumption about a feedstock mix for those plants. And then we go through, and as they come online, we look at the impact on the balance sheet for the feedstocks that we've chosen for their feedstock mix. And again, most of them sort of start off as low CI feedstocks. Well, if when they come online, they take, say, choice white grease feedstocks negative, Then we start to adjust their feedstock mix to include more more soybean oil. And so you get that big rise in soybean oil in our calendar year balance sheets, but you don't see that reflected in the gross margin charts just because of those choices that we made. And so, yes, it probably makes more sense to go back and adjust those charts so that the feedstock mix is the same as is essentially the ultimate feedstock mix that we get out of the calendar year balance sheets. That's a good point.
Okay. Tori, another question here, and this one was from a previous webinar that we weren't able to answer at the time because we ran out of time. In one of the previous webinars, there was a mention of camelina having an EPA pathway for D4 RINs. Is that for biodiesel only or for both biodiesel and renewable diesel? And does it have restrictions as only a cover crop? Is there an expectation that long-term camelina or canola growth will have some relief to soybean prices?
So I think right now is only for bio, the pathway is only for biodiesel, but I will double check that and we will follow up with whoever has asked this question. In terms of the potential production of camelina, it looks just very, from a very straightforward timing of crop cycles and that kind of thing, it looks like it fits in very well with soybean production. So you can essentially plant it after the soybean crop is harvested, and then it can be used in renewable fuel production. If that is the case, then I think you will probably see widespread adoption as the demand for biofuels increases. However, that said, there have been efforts to increase the planted area of camelina for a little while now, and they haven't really taken off as much as you would expect them to, given the fact that they don't necessarily have to, it doesn't displace soybean production or corn production, or for a farmer there, it seems like it would almost be free money. It's obviously not. You've got some costs associated with producing it, and you've got some risks associated with producing it, so it's not that, but it's a new source of revenue that they didn't have access to before. And I would think that farmers would adopt it pretty readily. I was talking to somebody else about this, and they, to be really honest about it, they didn't really know about anything about camelina. And we were talking about why there wasn't more of an uptake in camelina, and he kind of offhandedly said, is that the thing where the berries are poisonous or something? I don't even know that camelina has berries, but I think if that is the perception out there, that it may take some more education for the farming community and the community in general before you get sort of this widespread adoption. But potentially, let's assume that camelina is not poisonous. It seems like it could provide some relief to soybean oil prices. Now, soybean oil prices are ultimately also a function of soybean prices. And so right now you have, like I said before, historically tight US soybean stocks, and you haven't had the best growing season in South America. And so with soybeans at $14 or $16, it's going to be hard to get soybean oil prices to decline down to 28 cents or something. And also you have a situation where at least this past year and kind of going on a couple of years, you have pretty rapid growth in Chinese domestic vegetable oil demand that has outpaced Chinese vegetable oil supplies. As long as that continues, there's going to be a big draw for vegetable oils, and that's also going to support soybean oil prices. And so I don't think that ultimately camelina will be a magic bullet that that keeps the my forecast of 55-cent soybean oil by the end of the year from coming true. But I think in steps it might provide a little bit of relief, and maybe instead of 55 cents you get 50 cents or 52 cents or something like that in December. The other thing that you kind of have to remember is that at least right now, and probably for the foreseeable future, crushers don't crush to make soybean oil. They crush to make soybean meal, and then they try to figure out what to do with the soybean oil. And so the supply of soybean oil may be relatively tighter, or maybe relatively more ample compared to soybean oil demand, just because crushers match up the demand of soybean meal with crushing volumes. And so I think there are a lot of things that have the potential to limit the upside price risk in soybean oil. Camelina is certainly one of them, but if I put together a list of all the things that I think that that could keep the price from going up above 50 cents or well above 50 cents, camelina would not be near the top of that list. It wouldn't necessarily be near the bottom, but it wouldn't be in the top three or four things that potentially could change by the end of the year to keep that 55 cent price forecast from happening.
Torres, pretty much the last question we have time for. Going back to the UCO table that you spoke about earlier, can you talk about the metric that you're actually using there? And also, if you could comment on the UCO forecast at all.
The metric for production, is that
Yes.
about the per capita income?
Yeah, whatever metric you had in there, I'm sorry, that's all I have to go off. That's
Okay.
the question.
So per capita income, basically what we use is what we did to dive into a little bit more detail is we looked at, because we knew we wanted to use per capita income around the world, because that is a marker of development, and it's also, at least from an agricultural economics perspective, econ 101. Here's a quick lesson for the non-ag people on the call. Per capita income is very much related to something called sort of the protein ladder. And so as per capita income rises, there's a very set path that people tend to follow, or I guess countries or civilizations, however you want to term it, tend to follow. So the first thing that very poor countries eat is a lot of sort of rice and grains and very simple kind of foodstuffs like that. And then as they become a little bit richer, then they start to move up this protein ladder. And so ultimately they start to eat the less expensive forms of protein, so chicken and then pork and then ultimately steak and then, filet, and then the Japanese steak where they massage the cows and feed them beer. And so that kind of direct relationship is what we wanted to apply to our used cooking oil forecast, because we think that while maybe it won't work exactly this way until we have better data for used cooking oil, we think that this is probably a relatively good approximation. The other advantage to it is, quite frankly, is that there's good data for per capita income, both historically and forecast. And
Tor
so,
real quick, it's the production line on the table is 2,312 kilogram. And I'm not sure what per capita income can mean in this case. That's a clarity for you.
Okay, so the way that, I guess the way that we're using per capita income, so this is 2.3 billion pounds down to 2.0 billion pounds. And the way that we use per capita income to forecast production is we look at the relationship between what we assume production is and per capita income. And we assume that as per capita income rises, the production per person essentially also increases. And we've looked at this in the United States, and in the United States, we do something a little bit different, but we also do look at per capita income. In the United States, we get a series that shows spending on food at home and then spending on food away from home. And so we use that series actually to forecast our used cooking, or to estimate used cooking oil production. From that, then we look at the relationship between production and per capita income. And then for other countries, for countries that are just sort of starting at the bottom of the per capita income scale, or are lower in the per capita income scale, we assume a smaller per capita production or per person production of used cooking oil. But then as per capita income rises, we assume that that per person production of used cooking oil rises. This is not that every person produces used cooking oil, obviously, but just it's a way to try and get our arms around food consumption and the shift that occurs in food consumption as countries grow richer. So as they grow richer, one of the other things that they tend to do is they tend to shift from a lot of meals prepared at home to one, eating out, and then also they tend to shift from meals that are not processed at all, what we in the United States think of as really healthy eating. They, as they grow richer, they start to rely more on processed foods. And both of those things tend to increase the production of used cooking oil. And so we use per capita income is sort of an indicator of how a country is progressing along that path, if that makes sense. If it doesn't make sense and you still have some questions, or you want to talk a little bit more about this, shoot either George or I an email, and we can get together and spend a little bit of time talking about it on the phone.
All right. Well, Tori, we have to wrap up. Apologize to everybody for going a little long, but we had lots of questions to get answered today. We will have more next week when we have Ryan on. And thank you again for your time. Tori, thank you. And we'll talk next week.
Thanks, George. Bye. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.